being active in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I think when we first come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we really don't know. It's kind of like when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't sure what you had. And I really didn't know anything about AA other than the days of wine and roses and I'll cry tomorrow. I didn't know anything about alcoholics. I do not have an alcoholic in my family. So, and I often say my husband, my ex-husband and I spent 20 years in the Air Force, and I didn't, none of the people I hung out with, nobody I knew was an alcoholic. I've never seen any of them in AA. I don't think any of them need to be here. So it was, I'm a real alcoholic, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I think that Bob was saying that. I thought I was crazy. And, you know, you go to enough doctors, and you can, we look real weird. And, you know, you can be, I was diagnosed bipolar disorder. I was panic disorder. You name it. I had all of this stuff going on because I just could not live inside my own skin. And I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I was told to do was to get busy. Now, I spent 6 weeks in a treatment center. I often say I spent 6 weeks in a 28-day treatment center, but I stayed there 6 weeks. I was court committed to treatment because I went into that treatment center behind a suicide attempt. I absolutely could not stand to live inside my own skin. I don't think anybody describes that better than Clancy. Every time he talks about it, my whole body squirms. He often says, "Let me tell you what I'm like sober without a program." And that was me. I could not be sober. I couldn't stand. I was abusive. I am one of these people that came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am a child abuser. I am a child abuser in every way. I have abused my children physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and most of all by blatant neglect. I was incapable of taking care of my children. Today, I am a woman that would no longer be able to have her children because that's what happened to my children. My son is 48 years old today, and I can tell you he is not in the rooms of AA, and he is not in the rooms of Al-Anon, and he struggles. He struggles with alcoholism, and I'm powerless over that. I'm as powerless over him, powerless over alcohol, as I was over my own disease, powerless. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do that. So I get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I somehow have got to live inside my own skin. I am absolutely ravaged with guilt. I know that there's no way I can live with the kind of mother I've become, the kind of wife I've become, the kind of daughter I've become. I mean, here are my parents who loved and adored me, and I have broken their hearts time after time. My husband loves me, and I break his heart time after time, and I can't live with me. So what am I going to do until I can get that psychic change and have that spiritual experience? What am I going to do to stay sober? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show up to a lot of meetings because the first thing I've got is a sponsor. And I sobered up in Texas, and believe me, they said, you know, men work with men and women work with women. But what I believe today, and I don't ever say that. It doesn't anywhere in this book say that. And what I believe today is God will give me and you whoever we're supposed to have. I believe that with all my heart. And what happened was, as a result, you know, I was talking about all these God shots. You know, Roland Hazard, supposed to go to Sigmund Freud, ended up with Carl Jung, ended up in the Oxford group, knew a guy named Ebby, takes it to Ebby, Ebby takes it to Bill. All these little God shots. And if, I mean, Norm Alpe used to talk about inches and seconds and inches, seconds and inches. If anything had been different we wouldn't have gotten here. And I believe that's the same thing with sponsorship. We are going to get exactly who we need. And what happened for me was I had gone to a treatment center that had been a detox center, a county detox center, before I ended up in the long place. And it was a 7-day detox. And this man named Frank Fitzpatrick was the director of that treatment center. And what happened was, is he ended up 12-stepping me and bringing me back into that treatment center more dead than alive. And I couldn't stand what had happened to me in that motel where he 12-stepped me and brought me back into that treatment center. And what I ended up doing was trying to take my life after those 7 days were up. And what happened was, is I knew this was the man I needed to help me. Because for whatever reason, somehow, some way, I felt that he was who I was supposed to help. Now, there's an old man that was in Southern California. And today, he's been dead now almost 5 years. He'll be dead 5 years in July. And this man, to this day, is still the finest man I've ever known. And his name was Frank Honeycutt. And I met him when I was about 60, 70, 80 days sober, because he sponsored Frank. And he had started a meeting in Southern California because Frank was a captain in the Navy, and he had to have a meeting someplace where he could go. And he had been a priest, and he started this meeting. And that's how, and lo and behold, they were friends. Well, what happens is I end up in Southern California. Frank ends up being my husband's sponsor and my son's sponsor. I mean, seconds and inches. But what happened was, is I come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm told, get in the car. Get a sponsor. Gonna pull you along. What I do is, I am one of these people, when I see a newcomer, newcomers stand up the meeting. You should used to see us, and I still do it. My home group is the Third Legacy Group in Bellingham, Washington. We meet on Monday night at 7 o'clock. Dave and I are in the phone book. Pistol is my real name. Somebody came up to me and says, is that really your name? It is. My husband says that he's made me everything I am. Without that name, nobody would ever remember me. So we're in the phone book. When you sober up, you can be in the phone book. And if you're ever in Bellingham, please come. We'll take you to the Third Legacy. But what I do is, if I see a newcomer stand up, I am either, if I haven't got a sponsee really close by where I can give an elbow to, say, go get her number. It's not about me giving her my number. Get their number. And, you know, it's one of these things. I hope I never, ever get too sober to call another alcoholic, especially a newcomer. I am so grateful that Bill stood in that at that hotel and made 10 phone calls before he got to Reverend Tunks. I am so grateful so that he could talk to another alcoholic. I don't ever want to forget that kind of humility. So what I do is, if I don't hear from a newcomer, I call them, because somebody called me. And you know what they'd say? We're going to pick you up at such and such a time. Be ready. And then it's like, where are we going? I don't know. Get in the car. We're going to get in the car, and we're going to a meeting. And what happened was, is pretty soon I had 7 meetings that I needed to go to. And one of the things, and this is really hard in new sobriety. Now, I had teenagers. I drug my kids through alcoholism until they were 14 and 16 years old. But a lot of us have small children. And it sometimes becomes very difficult to get to a meeting every day. But new sobriety is absolutely, in my opinion, essential, that you get to a meeting every day. And if not 2 or 3 a day, get to a meeting. And then what happens is do something there. Just do something. And what I do when I've got a new person in tow is I'll just say, you know, help me pick up these cups. Because have you ever looked around how many people leave the mess of the present? The wreckage of the present just stays there. Let's pick up these cups. Just do something. Because I don't know about you, but Bob was talking about being a part of. and I must be a part of. And I don't know how to be a part of an Alcoholics Anonymous unless I'm doing something. And I need to be doing something. And I know that this is what I had to do for me, is to get busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and start to do something. Then, after a little while, we can sit down and we can move into there is a solution. And, you know, you sit down and you've got this person and you're working with them. And I don't know, wherever we started, this never was the way it used to be, but however we started interviewing sponsors. I mean, Frank was there. He was my sponsor. And I'm here today. I walk up to a newcomer, and if they stand up as a newcomer in my group, I say, do you have a sponsor? And what if they say no? I say, most of the time today, the women I sponsor need sponsees. I'll say, okay, Arlena's going to be your sponsor. And, you know, don't worry about what they're going to think. They don't know any better. They're newcomers. They're newcomers. They don't know. You know, and this is how we are. We think, well, I haven't been asked. Well, did you know what to do when you came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and how to ask for a sponsor? I didn't. I am so grateful that someone appointed themselves my sponsor. And Frank came up to me and he says, I'm your sponsor. You're so sick, you need someone like me. And I was. And I was sick a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sick a long time here before I got this program. But I'm here to tell you, I stayed sober. I stayed sober long enough in order to do the things to take the necessary actions so that I could have a psychic rearrangement and a spiritual experience. And what happens is, we're people who normally would not mix, but there exists amongst us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. Did you ever come in here and say, when you first were coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and say, I've got to go down there with all those poor old drunks? Because, you know, I don't know about you, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was in AA. So my vision of an alcoholic is some old, you know, low down, run down person. I had no idea. I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and people are laughing and they're excited to be there and they're hugging on each other. And I want that. I want that. So before I can do anything else in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to be attracted to the fellowship. I haven't got enough clarity and enough sense to work a step. I have got to be attracted to the fellowship. And I'm here to tell you today, I was not always an attraction to the fellowship. Sober, I was not an attraction. But I'm here to tell you today, I think it's so important to be an attraction. And I really, really, really try to emphasize that with the women I sponsor. Come on. You want the newcomer to want what you have. You want them to feel like you feel. And they're not, you know, there's nothing that's more disgusting than, you know, I've been sober for about 10 years. And, you know, and you're just looking at that guy and say, if I'm going to be sober 10 years and that's all I'm going to get, I'm out of here. I'm out of here. So what you do is we're an attraction. So now that we're sober, when the newcomer comes in, we want to make it attractive. We want a line, like, the, you know, a line. Hi, how are you? You got that at your home group? I bet you do. A greeting line. Bring them in. You know, it's like my sponsor, Dottie, said when she went to her first AA meeting and they stood up, she said she wanted to see what they looked like when they brought them in. And then her sponsor lifted her up. She said, oh, my God, I'm one. You know, I'm one of them. So the thing about it is we make it attractive. And that's before we do anything else with step one. We have to be in the middle doing something. Then we can begin to start to take step one. And we can start to look at where I'm powerless over alcohol. Where has alcohol, look what alcohol has done for my life. How many times could not I show up? Then I don't understand what's wrong with me when I sober up and then I'm hateful to my kids, I'm hateful to my husband, I'm restless, I'm irritable and discontent. Then I go back to the doctor's opinion and it's pointed out to me, you see, this is what happens. If you don't start to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the way it's going to feel sober. So I got to begin to do something. I've got to begin to have that feeling of usefulness that Bill talks about, and I've got to have it quick. I can't wait till the 12th step. I've got to begin to have that sense of usefulness. I got to feel like I'm a part of something and that I'm doing something. And that's where we begin to show newcomers. You know, I can remember when I was told to wash coffee cups. They had coffee cups when I first got sober. And we had to wash ashtrays. And I could not understand what that had to do with sobriety. What possibly could this have to do with sobriety? And I was told to just do it, follow a few simple rules, just do it, and someday you'll understand. Because there's nothing that's going to make you a part of than about four or five of you standing in the kitchen, washing cups, and just chatting away and talking. And then all of a sudden you begin to feel a part of. And then we can begin to sit down and say, okay, where am I powerless over alcohol? And then we get into, there's a solution. And in the solution, it begins to give us some stories. So how powerless we are. Talks about a man who stopped drinking for 25 years. And then he retires and he sits back and he's, you know, he's fine. I haven't had a drink for 25 years. I'm going to be fine. You know, if I get a backache, you know, God, I'm old. I'm 67 years old. You know, I'm kind of old. I got an ache here and an ache there. You know, it's not going to hurt me to take a little Vicodin. You know, make me feel a little bit better. And so I'm, you know, I don't have to get up in the morning and, you know, do this little shuffle until I get all the blood running, you know. And, you know, maybe a little Vicodin would feel good. And it begins to talk about having a lot, you know, the guy had 25 years of sobriety. But what happened is he wasn't doing a program of action. So what happens is I can't ever not be doing a program of action because it's always there. And it can happen to people like me. See, when I come to Park City, Utah, and when I get invited to share this podium with Bob, that's a privilege. That's a privilege that I get to do this. My sponsee, Sylvia, you know, she gets on an airplane and she comes with me. And we get to hang out together. That's a privilege. That's a privilege to get to do that. But I'm telling you, I wasn't worth taking out behind the barn and shooting. That's what I was when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, because of some beginnings, I began to know usefulness. And I began to know that usefulness early in sobriety. And the fellowship was an attraction. And I started feeling better and better by doing something. And then my sponsor sits down and we begin to look at the facts of my drinking. Where has my life been? Where am I powerless over alcohol? Where have I hurt my family? What have I done to my children? How many disappointments have I made? I've got to look at that. And then I have to stop and see where my life is unmanageable. How can I, you know, I don't pay the bills. My life is unmanageable. I can't get up and get to, you know, I can't take care of my children. My life is unmanageable. I am not capable of taking care of myself. I can't get myself to bed, and I can't get myself up. My children have to get themselves off to school because my life as a mom is unmanageable. And I drink when I don't want to drink. And I got to begin to see that. And I've got to accept it. The book says I have to accept it to my innermost self that I am mentally and bodily different from my fellows. I'm here to tell you, if you're brand new sitting in here and you think you're different and there's something wrong with you, you're right. You are absolutely right. The book tells me that. You're right. I am mentally and bodily different from my fellows. I don't operate like they operate. And I have to accept that to my innermost self and be willing to take a look at these steps, be willing to surrender to the fact that I am powerless over alcohol. Pause. And that powerlessness, the inability to not be able to stop drinking, no matter how much I want to, no matter how hard I try, makes my life unmanageable.
I'm Bob, still an alcoholic. What's it feel like to have an unmanageable life? It means you can't do stuff out here?
Ouch.
I think it's in here. Page 52. They call it the bedevilments. I think this is a description of an unmanageable life. The middle, right in the middle of the page, right square in the middle, it says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. That probably doesn't apply up here. It's big in Nevada, though. Oh, it's just... I get a phone call at 4 o'clock in the morning from a guy I sponsor. It usually starts out with, you'll never guess what she did. Right. We're having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Well, I can as long as people do things my way. We were a prey to misery and depression. Depression is not an SSRI deficiency. Depression is a symptom of early sobriety and untreated alcoholism. It's a depression. Depression is one of the major symptoms of if you've quit drinking and haven't worked the steps and aren't sponsoring anybody and your life's all about you. We couldn't make a living. Well, what's the making a living? Having money? No. We all know that feeling. It's just whatever you're doing, it ain't it. You know? I went through 9 jobs my first 4 years of sobriety. That's a pretty good indication of a guy who was staying sober on meetings and hadn't worked the steps yet. And it wasn't my fault. Every place I worked, they looked like a good job, and then I wouldn't even be there very long, and it's like their hideousness would just come out, you know, and I just realize how they're taking advantage of me, and they're just. I always work for self-centered people. We had a feeling of uselessness. Oh my God! All my life. That's what I loved about the. You know, I was a teenager towards the late '60s. You know, and early '70s when the hippie movement. People were talking about finding themselves. Yeah, find myself because I felt lost. This uselessness, like this feeling. What's life about? What's it mean? What am I supposed to do when I grow up? Which is a good thing to ask yourself when you're 15. When you're asking yourself that in your 25 or 30, it's like, what am I supposed to be when I grow up? Well, you've already grown up. I mean, you should know by now. We were full of fear. Oh, my God. We're talking about sober here. Full of fear. You know something? I didn't know that anxiety was fear. I didn't know that worrying was fear. I didn't know that that sense of apprehension that I walked around with was fear. I didn't know that that feeling I had when I woke up most mornings, like that something bad's going to happen today, was fear. I didn't know that remorse and guilt were fear of consequences and bad karma and stuff catching up with me and fear of what you thought of me or you'll find out what I did. Well, I was full of fear. I was unhappy. Boy, I sure was. I was that guy looking for the next fix, the next event, the next. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Pretty good description of me sober with untreated alcoholism. That coupled with the restless, irritable, and discontent feelings is a pretty good description of untreated alcoholism for a chronic alcoholic of my type. It's a pretty good description of me when I stopped drinking. If this phenomenon of craving, okay, let's say you've been through, this is your fourth treatment center and you finally understand you got the phenomenon of craving, because we're a little skeptical. I mean, I don't get it the first couple times. That's not me. So I got it, because I've tested it against a relapse. I found out that I'm the guy. I'm the guy. Once I start, I burn my life to the ground. I can't. If you're an alcoholic of my type, to pick up a drink is like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. And that's just the way it is, man. You can tell yourself, well, we're just going to have one dance, but it ain't that way. I mean, it's just your family probably tried to get between you and the gorilla, and they got mauled worse than you did. So I'm that guy. Once I start, and then I'm the guy who becomes all this stuff. The insides of me are emotionally unmanageable. And consequently, this relationship with the world is unmanageable. I suspect that unconsciously I drank alcohol because it was one of the most effective and immediate management tools I'd ever found to manage my internal reality. I could walk into a bar, as you probably have walked into bars, just frustrated, just up to here with life. Man, five drinks and... what was bugging me? I don't know. You know? Wow. Now that's a management tool. I mean, if a therapist could guarantee you that kind of an effect after one session of therapy, he could charge anything for that. Charge anything for that. So I can't manage my own life. But why do I... You know, you'd think in the light of why is it that some of us can go to several treatment centers and have everything on the table, everything at stake. As I was granted a great kindness by a judge. I didn't think so at the time. I was sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary, and all I had to do was stay in this recovery house for a year and get good UAs and I just had to not drink for a year, and I was a free man. Otherwise I'm gonna hang under a felony conviction and go to prison for 2 years. You'd think in that coupled with the light of what I'm doing to myself, my life is crap. As a result of chasing a party I can't catch. You'd think with all of that, that I should have been able to stay sober for a year, for God's sakes, under the gun of going to prison for 2 years? And I drank in the middle of that. I drank right in the middle of it. I couldn't do it. And you'd think that, well, okay, the restless, irritable discontent, but man, you could tough it out a year, for God's sakes, rather than going to prison. Like, rather than risk being the wife of Bubba. I mean, geez, you'd think you could tough out a year in a controlled environment, for God's sakes. I couldn't do it. And what when I picked up the first drink, it was like, although I couldn't see it. And page 24, it talks about this odd mental blank spots that we develop. It says the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Well, those of you that have relapsed a number of times after swearing to yourself you'll never touch it again, and you go back to it like a moth to a flame, I mean, you get that. You get it. But why? What's this craziness? What happens? Okay, I'm restless, irritable, discontent, but that wouldn't seem to explain it all. And then the next couple lines talks about a phenomenon that makes it virtually impossible to stay away from a drink. It says we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering, humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So what happens? Okay, I just got out of detox. I got a break here. I'm in this halfway house. I've sworn to myself I'm never going to drink again, and I mean it with everything in me. And as time goes on, I become progressively more restless, irritable, and discontent. My sponsor uses a great analogy. He says it's as if something has planted a spring in the pit of your stomach and life just starts to tighten it. Just slowly. Slowly. The boss. The traffic. The tax. Did you see how much they took out of my paycheck? After I'm sober here and nobody really appreciates it. You know, just tighter. Just tighter. Tighter. Why can't I get them to see? Why are they so stupid at work? Why don't they do it? It'd be easier to do it this way. No, they got to do it the stupid way. Tighter, tighter, tighter. Do you see who's running our government? Oh, tighter, 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 tighter. And at the same time, the further I get away from the last drink, the vaguer and the hazier the memory of the pain is. And there comes a time where I can't grab onto it. A gal told me years ago that that's the same dynamic that happens with childbirth. That if a woman could really experientially bring back the pain of childbirth and really get what that felt like, she'd never do that again. But what happens is you see the cute little babies and you it wasn't that bad, was it? Or in our case, you see the guys you work with that they're telling you the stories about the great party they went to the night before. And when the yearning for relief and freedom gets on me, it's funny, I can't see past it. It consumes me. That's why they call it a mental obsession. It just gets right here. Now, over here, peripherally, oh, there was the fact I'm on paper and going to go to prison if I pick up a drink. But you can't see that because I can't see past the hope of relief. I can't see past the yearning to bust out, to just go and get out of here. And I pick up a drink and the whole process starts over again, and it's a bad deal. Page 30 30 talks about two delusions or illusions. One, they call one an illusion, the other a delusion. To this day, I'm still not quite sure what the difference between a delusion and a delusion is. I've looked in the dictionary, and I still don't get it. I know five of you are going to explain it to me at the break, but I have had it explained to me by a lot of people, and I still don't understand the difference. But anyway, it says this first one is what kept me from getting a foothold in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could never get sober as long as in the back of my mind was this idea that the book says about six lines down, it says the idea that somehow, someday, possibly some way, you know, like under the right set of circumstances, that I will be able to control and enjoy my drinking. The book says this is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The idea, this sense, this yearning, this feeling that under the right set of circumstances, if my abstinence is boring enough, scary enough, frightening enough, frustrating enough, lonely enough, that I could probably for a weekend, I'm not going to hurt anybody, just for a weekend, for God's sakes. I've been in this halfway house, washing dishes, making my bed, going to those stupid AA meetings. I've been a really good sport up to now. Just for a weekend that I could go out and have some fun, that I get, the book says, enjoy it. And I don't like trouble, I'll keep the damage down to something reasonable. That's the delusion. Just psychotic, wishful thinking. My last run, I went out on that last run because I fancied that I could do it. I could jumpstart a party that I hadn't been able to jumpstart in several years. And I thought I could get away with it. And instead, I went to the bar with my friend and I'm excited, starting the run. And I started throwing down those double shots of 100 proof whiskey with the beer back, so wanting to get there, and I don't like getting there. What I'm getting is the phenomenon of craving and waves of self-pity. As I always like the word depression better. I don't like self-pity. So there's nothing, self-pity is not a manly emotion. When I'd be depressed, people would say, are you feeling sorry for yourself? I don't even want to kill him. Can't get any medication for self-pity. You can get medication for depression. I like depression. Yeah. You don't understand. I have depression. But the depression, the self-pity starts coming over me because I'm looking at the people that are having fun and laughing and carrying on. And it's breaking my heart because I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't get that back. And I never made it back to the halfway house Sunday night. At the end of my pass, I came to Monday morning in a county jail. And that was finally where this delusion was smashed, this idea. I finally got it that no matter what I take, no matter what I drink, no matter what I do, doesn't matter if I was sober 10 months and working out, it doesn't matter if I was taking vitamins, it doesn't matter if I had money in my pocket, it doesn't matter if I had a good relationship, it doesn't matter. I cannot get back to the old days, period. You know how we know that because we've tried. We tried. I don't know anybody. I mean, you take a normal drinker, a non-alcoholic, and if they're every time they drank, they got as pathetic and pitiful as we got the end of our drinking, I don't think they would do that more than once. I don't think they would, you know, throwing up and feeling sorry for themselves and whining, I want to kill myself. I don't think they're going to do that a lot. I think one time and they'd go, man, I ain't ever doing that again. Not me. It's like, oh, it's going to be good this time. right. My friend Angie, who I just love, Angie says, I don't know if that's insanity. I think we just get stuck on stupid. and then the second one, And this is what, that's what kept me from getting in the door of AA, that idea that I could, because if you unconsciously, subconsciously suspect you've got a party that you can reap, you're going to reap it. You're going to try. One day, your abstinence is going to justify it. One day, something's going to justify it. Matter of fact, I've seen alcoholics create stuff to justify it. And you'll try it because you got a back door right out of your own abstinence. I don't have a back door anymore. And when you don't have a back door out of your abstinence, and you know absolutely in the pit of your stomach, in your innermost self, that there's no ease and comfort left in the bag and the bottle. Now when your emotions start putting the screws to you and the restless, irritable, and discontent starts, is on you, and the loneliness and depression of abstinence is on you, now I got to call that sponsor. You know, the guy that, you, and you know you're smarter than him. You got to call him and he'll give you some stupid direction to take that doesn't make any sense. You'll go more to those meetings, you guys. You know why? Because you don't have any alternative. You're used up. You don't have nothing else to do. So you do the stuff you never would do. And then oddly enough, your life starts to change. And then about three lines down in the second paragraph, this is what takes people out. This is why I think this, and it talks about this in the warning in step 10, but this is why I suspect people, a lot of people with many years of sobriety drink again. It says the delusion that we are like other people. What other people? Well, probably, I guess non-alcoholics, because the chapter's called more about alcoholism. The delusion that I'm normal. What is it about? It's, you know, a dog never goes around trying to be a cat. Why do I want to be a non-alcoholic? I mean, you know, but I spent a lot of my life just trying to fix this, get over it. Diabetics don't do that. When a diabetic accepts he's got diabetes, he's got diabetes. He never sits around and imagines that, you know, I had such a good diet, I'm probably no longer diabetic. You know, he never imagines that. Never imagines that. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. How do you see evidence of this delusion? That's the funny thing about a delusion, it's not conscious. You're not saying to yourself, oh, I'm no longer alcoholic. You know where you're saying it? You're saying it in your feet. Watch the guys in your group that got sober and that went to 7, 8, 10 meetings. What they did is they had an attitude of they went to absolutely every meeting they could possibly go to that didn't interfere with their inherent responsibilities. How much AA can I do? They were calling their sponsor all the time. They didn't make a move without their sponsor. They had commitments. Somebody said, we need somebody that... Their hand went up. They were involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're trying to work these steps. They're chipping away at the amends. They're starting to sponsor people. And then what happens is the fruits of that action, what it happens is it's a constant cause and effect. As your spirit gets vitalized and lit up, you start, the outside start to get good. Cause and effect. It's almost the mirror image of the road into the abyss. The road out is very similar. It's like the mirror image of it. And now maybe at 5 years sober now, maybe you're making $100,000 a year. Maybe you finally bought your first house. You got that relationship you always wanted. People respect you. You've made most of your amends. People aren't chasing you. There's nobody out there. Nobody looking for you with a baseball bat no more. Matter of fact, when the cop pulls you over, you're proud to give him your license. Kind of try to breathe on him. And what happens? It's so human to get a sense, a feeling like there's not a problem here anymore. I mean, it doesn't feel like a problem. I mean, things are good. And what happens is we, all of a sudden, the next thing you know, I don't really need to go to meeting every day anymore because I'm a busy guy. Got big stuff on. I got big deals going on. Big deals. And you hear people say, this is the crazy. You hear people say things like this. They say, well, it's about time I start striking balance in my sobriety, my life. I think what they really said is, I think I'm going to take the reins again. I mean, listen, objectively, if you look at your track record, like I look at my track record, what would a guy like me know about balance? I mean, come on. Come on. I mean, if you hear me saying I'm going to start putting balance in my life, get out of the way. There might be a splatter zone. I mean, just, it's right. What do I know about balance? That's why I got God to sponsor. I wouldn't know balance if it ran me over in the road, man. Balance. We didn't get sober just to do AA. Man, you forgot. If when you were dying, laying in that detox, and you'd have done anything to not be there again, somebody has said, well, will you do AA the rest of your life if you don't have to sober up again? You'd have said, you bet. Now it's not enough anymore. And we start compromising. We start acting like someone who's normal. There's a funny line on page 22. This is often, I got in this conversation years ago with a guy, and I was in a workshop just like this, and we were talking about this delusion we're like other people. And he came up to me at the break, and he says, that's not true. It says in the book we are like other people after when we're sober. And I said, no, I don't think it does. He says, let me show you in the bottom page 22. And it's in the last paragraph, it says, we know that while alcoholics keep away from drink, as they may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. Much like is not quite the same. A transvestite's much like a woman. But he's not. I'm telling you. Oh, he's not. You saw the crying game. He's really not. What that means, much like, that means on a good day, I can fool him. I can fool him. On a bad day, it's hard to fool them. On a bad day, it's hard. On a good day, nobody. On a really good day, when I'm contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, when I'm in a good spot, I have nothing, no unresolved stuff, no resentments that are eating me alive, none of that stuff. And me and God are good. Me and you are good. I don't even know. I feel like I can fit right. Nobody knows I'm an alcoholic. I could be in a whole bunch of normies. I don't stand out. Nothing. Now I get a little weird, and we'll see. But even then, I've learned I've got some pretty good defense mechanism. I can fool them. But I will always, always, always live in the shadow of alcoholism. Good days, I'm not even aware it's there. Bad days, yeah. You know those mornings where you wake up afraid? There's more where you're feeding the wrong dog and your ego's out of line, and yeah. I'm not like other people. There's a couple things on here. It talks about the science. There's no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this. It hasn't done so yet. I can't. Never will. I wish they'd stop it. Stop it. I think it's crazy, untreated Al-Anon scientists in laboratories trying to fix us, you know, because they're thinking we're like their dad or something. They're gonna make us right, and every 4 or 5 years they come out with something. I remember back from the RAND report, they're always coming out with stuff. The latest, the one a couple of years ago, was so crazy. They had this euphoric blocker that they used in England for heroin addicts, and they figured out worked with alcoholics. They'll give you this pill. Now you drink, you don't get high. So alcoholics would drink and become so suicidal because they weren't getting high, they had to give them large doses of antidepressants on top of the... I mean, that's stupid. stop it. Because even if they didn't come out of it with a pill that would turn us into a social drinker, I'm going to be taking 10 or 15 of them right off the bat, man. I'm just, you know, I'm going to, how social can I get? Bottom of 31, there's a test. It says you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take you long for you to decide if you're honest about with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. 19. 39. What was at risk to try that was a bad case of the jitters. So our society is up the ante quite a bit. And it's not a good test. If you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and that is a mind that works against you, and you don't know it, and you go into a bar and you're going to say if you're an alcoholic, and you take the test, and you're going to have two drinks, and then you're going to shut her down, and you're going to go home, no, can't smoke nothing, take nothing, nothing, two drinks, that's it. Halfway through the second drink, it will become very apparent to you that this is a bad test day. There'll be somebody in the bar you need to have a drink with. The game is on. Oh, my God, did you see the game? And it's like a key turns in your head, and it's a bad test day. Tomorrow will be a better test day. And then somewhere between the first sip of the first drink and the back of the second drink, as the effect starts to come over me, the craving, the allergic reaction to alcohol occurs, and it uses my own mind against me to make the next drink seem absolutely appropriate in my idea. And I never got that I was in the grip of a phenomenon of craving, an allergic reaction to alcohol.
Anything before we quit? Want to dump quit?
We'll come back in 23 hours and 37 minutes.